Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island. Since 1988, Goose Island has been following their curiosity and are committed to innovating how and what they brew. More at gooseisland.com. We don't need to be the only beer you drink. We just want to be the best beer you drink.
This is Sound Opinions, and Greg, like a lot of musicians, Kurt Cobain left a mountain of cassettes behind him. On one, he had written, "Scraps and insignificant discarded material under no circumstances release after my death." Yet, here we have a record, Montage of Heck, the home recordings. We're going to dive into that later on Sound Opinions.
You're listening to Sound Opinions, and that's Parliament with Flashlight from 1978, Bernie Worrell. There are analog synths all over that song. Specifically, that unforgettable bass line is played on the Mini Moog synthesizer. When we think about analog synths, Moog's probably the name that comes to mind immediately for a lot of people. And for years, the company's flagship has been the Mini Moog Voyager, a slightly modernized version of the same keyboard on that Parliament track. You know, Trent Reznor in an interview recently said the Mini Moog's the archetype of what a synthesizer is and should be. So we were surprised when the Moog company announced recently that it would no longer produce that particular instrument, especially as it comes at a time when interest in analog synths is higher than it's been in years. You look at the charts, you've got M83 and Passion Pit scoring hits that bring back that vintage sound of the 70s and 80s. Last year, you had Future Islands topping a lot of critics' best of 2014 lists with Seasons Waiting on You, a very retro synth-heavy song. So now you've got acts like Churches, Grimes, Carly Rae Jepsen, even Taylor Swift making synth-pop-inspired records. When Robert Moog debuted the Moog synthesizer back in the late 60s, I mean, little did he know that his creation would become the centerpiece of so many records for so long.
Greg, it's no exaggeration to say the Moog is as important to rock history as the Fender Telecaster or the Gibson Les Paul. Why do musicians love these instruments so much? We thought it was worth revisiting our chat with Brian Kahu from back in 2010. Now, Brian's a musician, a producer, he's been the historian for the Bob Moog Foundation, and we started by going over the early history of the Moog. Bob Moog started developing electronic music instruments in the early 60s, starting with the theremin. He loved those things. He first attached a keyboard to one of these instruments in 1964. We asked Brian to tell us about that early technology.
What he made was a collection of circuits where you could create sound from scratch. And if you think about it, before that, there were electronic instruments. There were theremins, there were Hammond organs. But his idea was to create something where you could make your own sounds rather than just play music or a theremin, for example, controls a sound. His idea was to synthesize something from component parts. So you could put together this tone and that tone, filter and shape, and you could build something from the ground up, kind of paint by numbers, if you will, with sound. And that was kind of a new idea.
I always love the story, the image of a young Robert Moog, 14 years old, he gets this electronics magazine. It has a circuit, how to build your own theremin at home, and that's what got him started.
Yeah, the theremin was actually an obsolete instrument by the time he was getting into it. It was designed in the 1920s by the Russian inventor Lev Theremin, and Bob had kind of been interested in this thing, but it was kind of over and done by the time he did it, then tried to make a few commercially, and they'd failed. So he thought, here's a cool circuit I can build, and then he and his father put together the very first ones that he made in the workshop below their house.
By the time in the early 60s he gets to actually building the first Moog synthesizers, as you said, collections of circuits. We think of a synthesizer today, I think most lay people, as something with a keyboard. But these things were huge. They were like the size of a refrigerator, all these different modules that you had to, like an old-fashioned telephone switchboard, you had to patch in and out. And the first one was like $11,000.
Well, one thing that was cool about it, and I think this is a great idea even for today, was his circuits could be designed to be combined in any size. So you could actually get a very small one if you wanted. Most people didn't. They wanted more power. They wanted more flexibility. But you could buy, you know, just one or two modules and use a filter on your radio or on your keyboard. So it's like buying applications for your phone. You can't have enough of them, or software for your computer.
When do we start seeing applications of this device into popular music?
Well, popular music is an interesting term. The first popular record with the Moog was Wendy Carlos, who created Switched on Bach, which is a classical record done with synthesizer only. About the extremes of that, classical music was the furthest thing from electronics. So in a way, for her to be using it was a very bold step. It was to try to prove that this was as valid an instrument as a piano or a violin, which is considered very traditional, although they are technology of their time. So it was kind of interesting.
The thing we always have to point out to people is when Wendy was making the music of Bach on the synthesizer, this was a monophonic instrument at the time, which meant you got one note at a time. So to make a chord, you would have to overdub four or five notes, right?
Exactly. You'd take one pass and do the low notes in the chord, and then one pass do the middle notes and so forth.
So how long do you figure it took her to actually do the whole Bach concertos that she was recording?
It's fascinating to listen to because there's so many notes in those as well, too. But when she recorded things, it was also not the easy way out. The way you and I might do it is to get the keyboard from a shop and then plug in the flute sound and play it. But she would create the sound from scratch and then also vary it as she played the way a real player plays. So it's not just a beginner's version of it. It's the most advanced form of it is to make the sound shape and change as you play, which most keyboard players still don't do. In answer to your question, it's probably weeks and weeks, if not months, per piece, probably several months of each piece.
That's incredible. Where did she get the idea to apply it to a piece of music like that? I assume that prior to this, Brian, it had been used primarily for avant-garde music, experimental-type music forms?
Yeah, the cool thing was, though, that there's a few pop people that you wouldn't expect had bought synthesizers, like the Byrds and the Monkees, and they were some of the first synthesizer users.
Mm-hmm.
But they weren't doing records that were very well known, and the little bits they did use is just kind of space noises. So it was considered a sound-making tool, but it was being made for... In fact, Bob even designed it for people that wanted to make weird sounds, really.
Mm-hmm.
But Wendy Carlos was the first commercial record that really took off, and it was the most popular classical record for many years that it ever sold, for decades at least. It was the top classical record of all time.
How difficult would it have been for someone in that era to play or even master this instrument? For a layman... You know, what's the difference between learning to play the Moog synthesizer and, say, a piano or a saxophone?
Oh, it's playing it itself is not the hard part. It's because this thing comes with no preset sounds that's the real challenge. So it comes out of the box and you unpack it. You've got to set up a bunch of cables and switches and knobs. Even to get the worst sound out of it, you've got to get something going. And the funny part was for many years they didn't even have an instruction manual with it. They'd not really written one out. What they used to have was a piece of paper called a patch diagram. And you'd draw the kind of picture of the synthesizer, and they would draw in the chords and the switches where you might want to put them to put a beginning sound. And you'd start there, turning knobs up or down and adjusting settings so you can get what you wanted out of it. But it would definitely be frustrating to a lot of people. And they used to, I think they really didn't understand that when they first built it. They were engineers and people that understood how things worked, so they kind of assumed that the dumb musician could do it too, and it didn't always work that way.
Let's talk about when it began to be a more practical instrument in rock. It's been said of the Mini Moog that what Kraftwerk, the German experimental band turned pop band, did with the Moog was similar to what Chuck Berry did with the electric guitar. But when did we start to see smaller machines that had the keyboard attached that weren't the size of switchboards?
It actually wasn't Moog's invention to do that, although they had made very small systems. As I said, you could buy a small thing for your school or for your, you know, tabletop if you wanted to. But in England, there was a little keyboard called the Synthi, the VCS3, if you will. It's a little portable English synthesizer that has three oscillators and a filter. And that very much was the first small portable type kit you could take around. A lot of people like that, and I think Moog was even inspired by that. and they soon after made their own Minimoog, which is a small version of the big system. So the Minimoog became the most well-known keyboard probably in the 1970s. I think it outsold everything by far.
Soon enough, we start seeing these progressive rock musicians with 5, 6, 8 synthesizers sitting on top of their Mellotrons and their Hammond organs, and it's really an inspiring sight.
True, it's inspiring, but it's also limiting to the poor person that has to haul them around, or more likely, the roadie who has to take them around. But the reason for this, and people may not understand it, is that nowadays when you go to buy a keyboard, it has sounds built in. You can push a button for a piano, push a button for strings. And the keyboards back then, you had to literally create sounds from scratch, which is half the fun of it and half a limitation. If I want a bass sound on song number one, I've got to stop between song number one and two and reset 15 or 20 knobs and get a flute sound for song number two. So they would often have a keyboard for each sound. So you'll have one for my kind of harpsichord sound, I'll have a different one for my bass sound, a different one for my lead sound, and then do very few changes because I bought 12 keyboards to take on tour.
Wow. So let's get this straight here. Back in that era, what kind of an expense are we talking about, and how much would one of these things weigh?
Well, the expense would be something around the neighborhood of like a Minimoog would be around $1,200 to $1,500. And that was 1970s money. You could buy 3 guitars for that price.
Mm-hmm.
So a guitar player was easily set up with his guitar and an amp before the keyboard player even had one keyboard, much less a mixer or an amp to put it through or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
So it's definitely a limitation is the price. And that was a very small, cheap one, somewhere $5,000, in fact. And that's in 1970s money. That's the price of a car.
Sure.
Pretty expensive. And the poor keyboard guy, you know, had to do this to keep up with the Joneses and to be trendy and whatever cool sounds were on the radio. You had to have at least one keyboard in that price range. And you asked about weight. Most of these were things you could carry under your arm or put them in a flight case and roll them along. But you could easily have 100 pounds in a typical keyboard. And if you're carrying 6 or 8 keyboards, that's a lot of weight.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You not only had to have a certain amount of vision as a musician, but you also had to, it was work. It was a rigorous thing. It was also an economic burden. You really had to want these things in order to make music on them.
But there's also an element that's kind of visually impressive. You remember bands with the big amplifiers that stood as tall as they were on stage, and they'd line the back of the stage with Marshall amplifiers, and it was a very impressive, powerful thing. So if you see Keith Emerson from Emerson, Lake & Palmer, or Rick Wakeman from Yes, they're surrounded by these giant and big keyboards. It's a very powerful, strong sign to see someone on stage doing that. Nowadays, if the same person walks out with a laptop, it's not very impressive.
That's,
so
yeah,
there was
true.
An element of it that was actually great for showmanship. It was great for the power of rock and roll. It was great for exciting people. And people said, I want to be that guy up there because he's surrounded by all these cool things and making it into great music.
You could not help but wear a cape while playing one, right?
Or silver boots or something like that. Yeah, for sure.
Brian Eno's ostrich feathers.
Yeah.
Yes.
For people who've never had the pleasure of tinkering with a memory Moog or a mini Moog, and I have. I'm a drummer, but I love these machines. I think one of the things that's hard to convey to people is just what you were saying before. You might have to turn 15 knobs and dials to get a sound. That can be frustrating. If you want to say, please make your synthesizer, the producer says, sound like a flute. Good luck. You know, maybe you'll get there in an hour. Maybe you won't. In the meantime, you're going to hear, like, you know, the Martian elephants and, the narwhals wailing, you know. And that's the joy. You never know what's going to happen when you turn one of those knobs.
It's very true. And in fact, when I first got my first synthesizer in the 1970s, I had no idea how it worked, but we would set it up and make a noise, and I'd fess with the knobs until I kind of learned what function that one did. Oh, that makes the pitch go up and down. And this one makes it darker and brighter. So it's a challenge, but it also means that you're going to create something unique to you because you're not trained the same way as everyone else. So a Brian Eno would sound different than the guys from Kraftwerk, and that would sound different than Keith Emerson because they knew how to work it in a different way.
Now it seems to me so strange.
It's almost like these machines had personality. They were so unstable that they literally had their own set of sounds unique to that particular machine.
Yes, there's a bit of it where they've made choices for you. You've only got 15 knobs, and they've chosen which ones you get to adjust, but that's thousands of possibilities. And so as you're playing with it, you're going to come up with some really interesting things that maybe a trained person, in fact, like myself, who knows what he's doing now, of course, would not make the same choices because that's not the way we do things. But some kid who walks in and just turns knobs could make an amazing sound.
I think that that's one of the things that bands are going back to now. Now, we mentioned you were a producer. I mean, that fantastic album, Extraordinary Machine, with Fiona Apple. I've seen you credited on records by, you know, everybody from John Bryan to the Eels and Amy Mann.
Yep.
So people come to you and they say, hey, work some of that old synth magic. People are drawn to the old Moogs in particular because of the very weirdness and unpredictability.
Yeah, it has an interesting thing. A lot of them have been given too much reputation for that, although they do kind of stay in tune. They don't go crazy out of tune, otherwise you wouldn't be able to use them, but they drift a bit, and that's a lot like a guitar, which drifts a bit, or a violin, or a human voice, which drifts a lot sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
So you can definitely use things like that. They don't have to be perfectly stable. There's an element of that that I think makes it more human, more organic, and so people don't treat it as too synthetic, whereas a very modern keyboard is always perfectly in tune, always perfectly stable if you want it to be.
As Jim was saying, there's a lot of contemporary groups that seem very much drawn to that early era of the synthesizers that you were talking about. There's sort of a romance about it. How difficult is it to get that quote-unquote vintage synthesizer sound that they're looking for? I mean, are these instruments widely available? How easy are they to get and put on a record?
Yeah, they're actually pretty easy nowadays because some people have gone away from that world. They've gone into software and laptops. But there's a lot of old instruments floating around, and they're not all expensive. And I think it's an interesting draw why people want these. You mentioned a lot of current bands still use them. I think part of it is the nostalgia effect, or maybe that they're fond of Stevie Wonder records, even if they weren't born then, and they like those sounds. The other part of it is the interface is so much fun. Volkswagen called it Farvergnügen, which is the human interface. How much connectivity do you have with your thing? How much controllability? And they really designed these things to have a great attention to that. They have big knobs. They have big switches. They have kind of a fun interface instead of just some little clickety, tiny plastic switches. So in a lot of cases, I think people are drawn to it because they enjoy working the instrument.
We'll continue our celebration of the Moog synthesizer and its role in rock and roll after a short break on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and PRX. And then we'll review a posthumous release from Kurt Cobain, and I'll drop a quarter in the Desert Island Jukebox.
Die Luke ging auf, da sprang ein Mann heraus.